It's a personal pleasure to introduce my good friend and colleague, Rex Lee, to this forum. I met Rex nearly 17 years ago, just after he had been appointed dean of a new law school in Provo, Utah, a law school without faculty, building, book, or student. He was preparing then for his deanship by visiting law schools, learning what he could from personal observation, and I was an overaged law student at the University of Utah. In the years since that first meeting, I've come to admire the man who holds records both as Solicitor General of the United States and as a private attorney for arguing more cases before the Supreme Court in any single term than anyone in the history of the court. In the October 1983 term, while Rex was Solicitor General, the government won a higher percentage of its cases in the Supreme Court than it had in any term since the Justice Department began keeping modern statistics. The National Law Journal lists Rex as one of the 100 most influential lawyers in the United States. He holds honorary Doctor of Law degrees from 5 universities. I remember when Rex returned to the law school faculty after his term as Solicitor General. Rex's office is one floor above mine, and I climbed the stairway to welcome him back. Before I entered the hallway on Rex's floor, I heard his voice coming from more than halfway down the hall as he talked on his telephone with that familiar voice which carries so well. In a flash of deja vu, I knew I would find him intently pacing back and forth in his office, gesturing with his hands, talking on the phone. And in that moment, I was struck by how very much we had missed him while he had been in Washington. Rex grew up in St. John's, Arizona, and served a mission to Mexico. He received his bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University, where he was elected student body president, and his law degree from the University of Chicago. After law school, Rex was a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Byron White. He returned to Arizona and worked for one of the premier law firms in Phoenix, where later he became a partner. In 1971, he became founding dean of the BYU Law School. In 1975, Rex took a leave of absence from the law school and went to Washington to become Assistant U.S. Attorney General, Civil Division. He returned as dean of the law school in 1977, only to leave again in 1981 to become Solicitor General of the United States. In 1986, Rex returned to the faculty of the law school as the George Sutherland Professor of Law and became a partner in Sidley & Austin, one of the nation's finest law firms. His law practice is almost exclusively arguing before the United States Supreme Court. Of all of his long list of impressive victories, two stand out above all the rest. The first is his remarkable success in persuading Janet Griffin to marry him. They have 7 children. Janet was the key figure in the second of his most impressive victories, his miraculous recovery in the last 11 months from a gravely serious cancer. Rex has served as a branch president, a bishop twice, although one of his terms as bishop was short, only 2 weeks, when he was called by Elder Neil Maxwell to serve as president of the BYU Seventh Stake. We will now be pleased to hear from Rex E. Lee.
I really enjoyed what Reese said, and if he has some more, I'd be glad to yield some time to him. Because the subject of my remarks this morning has in it the word Constitution, it fits within my particular academic interest and therefore is a proper subject for me to discuss. But I was also concerned that it also has within it the name religion, and I thought that that might be interpreted as poaching on someone else's turf. But yesterday, Don Cannon explicitly gave me the permission, license, to talk about that subject for one day. Specifically, what I want to talk to you about are 16 very important words. They are the first 16 words in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and their content is as follows. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. There are two key phrases in those 16 words, establishment of religion and free exercise. Both deal with religion, but their concepts are quite different. The free exercise clause is a close relative to the other provisions of the First Amendment, in that it contains a guarantee of individual liberty. And like the other provisions of the First Amendment, it deals specifically with a means of individual expression and conduct. But even more than the other First Amendment expression rights, such as freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of association, the free exercise of religion guarantee also reaches matters of belief. The Establishment Clause, by contrast, is the only First Amendment provision that does not deal directly with individual rights. On its face, it's a structural provision. Now, what does that mean? As a structural provision, it is concerned not directly with individual rights, but rather with maintaining a certain degree of separateness between two kinds of institutions, governments on the one hand and churches on the other. The clearest an example of an Establishment Clause violation, and incidentally the one that the draftsman of the First Amendment clearly intended to prohibit, would be the creation or the maintenance by government of an official, exclusively recognized governmental church, such as the Anglican Church was in Virginia until the late 18th century. And indeed, it came out of that Virginia experience with an established church in the 18th century that we have both of the religion clauses in the First Amendment. Those clauses result principally from the efforts of two Virginians, Jefferson and Madison, with substantial contributions made by a third son of the Old Dominion, George Mason. To those of us who are so accustomed to taking their legacy for granted, it is difficult to realize that just a short 200 years ago, Virginians of an equal stature, including principally Patrick Henry, but also to a lesser extent George Washington and James Monroe, were squarely opposed to something that today we regard as so basic as a prohibition against official state religions. During one of the Virginia debates, Jefferson, who was then in France, wrote to Madison, commenting on Patrick Henry, that, and this is a quote, "What we have to do, I think, is devotedly pray for his death." Though they did not succeed in the more immediate and concrete issue of divine intervention to shorten Patrick Henry's life, Jefferson and Madison did prevail over their fellow Virginians on the larger issue. And one of the most significant events in our national history actually occurred in the Virginia State Legislature on January 16, 1786, when that body enacted the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. It was the predecessor of our First Amendment religious liberty clauses. We all remember from our high school and college history classes that Jefferson's authorship of this particular statute, which he actually wrote 7 years earlier while the Revolutionary War was going on, was one of the three accomplishments for which this third president of the United States wished to be remembered. Probably not as well known, but equally significant, is the fact that while this statute's famous author was in France, his friends, Madison and Mason, stayed at home and performed the difficult task of getting Jefferson's concepts enacted into law. Moreover, it was this same Madison, more than any other single person, whose dogged determination was ultimately responsible for adoption of the Bill of Rights 5 years after its predecessor, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, was passed by the Virginia Assembly. Today, the religion clauses are among the most fruitful sources of our constitutional litigation, and they have been since the early 1940s. But it was not always thus. As astonishing as this fact is to those of us who have been following the work of the Supreme Court over the last quarter of a century, it is nonetheless true that from the time of their adoption in 1791 until the 1940s, more than 150 years, the only religion cases, the only cases raising issues under either the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause, involved the ancestors of some of the who were in this audience. They were the polygamy cases that came up during the late 19th century. Another significant historical note is this. I'm sure you're all paying very careful attention when I gave you those 16 words. You will note that the First Amendment says that Congress cannot establish a religion nor prohibit its free exercise. Does this mean that notwithstanding the First Amendment, Virginia, if it wanted to do so, could reestablish the Anglican Church as the official church of the state of Virginia? Or that Maryland or Utah could do the same thing for the Catholics or whatever religion Utah happened to pick at random? For at least 8 decades of our nation's history, the answer to that question was yes, at least insofar as the federal constitution was concerned. The United States Supreme Court held in 1834, in a case called Barron versus Baltimore, that the provisions of the Bill of Rights, not just the First Amendment, but the entire first 8 amendments, are binding only on the federal government and not on the states. Now, the practical impact of its holding was blunted by the fact that provisions similar to the Bill of Rights were contained in most state constitutions. But insofar as the federal constitution was concerned, for at least 80 years, our national Bill of Rights provided no protection against anything that the states did related to religious practices or anything else. It was not until the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868 that there was any basis in our national constitution for applying the religion clauses or any other provision of the Bill of Rights to the states. And over the intervening 120 years, the 14th Amendment has been interpreted to mean that most of the Bill of Rights provisions, including the Establishment and Free Exercise clauses, are binding on the states as well as the federal government. There is an interesting irony relative to this that pertains to our own Mormon history. Most of us have grown up knowing that we should despise President Martin Van Buren for telling the prophet Joseph Smith, your cause is just, but there is nothing I can do for you. Van Buren may well deserve our disdain because I suspect that he was not a constitutional scholar and his response was based on purely political considerations, as we have always assumed that they were, that it was. But the irony is that from a technical, legal standpoint, Van Buren was right, because the wrongs of which the prophet Joseph Smith complained were committed by the state of Missouri. And in those pre-14th Amendment days, there was no federal law to protect against that sort of thing. After having been absent from our constitutional jurisprudence for a century and a half, the religion clauses have definitely made up for lost ground over the past 40 years. Over those 4 decades, there have been literally scores of Supreme Court decisions defining what is meant by establishment of religion and what is meant by free exercise. The bodies of law applicable to each of these separate provisions have developed largely independent of each other, though on occasion they converge, and the convergent areas are among the most interesting and the most difficult of our constitutional jurisprudence. What I propose to do is to review first the Establishment Clause cases, then the free exercise cases, and finally, those areas in which they overlap. Let's look first at what is meant by an establishment of religion. Almost from the beginning, we have attempted to describe what the Establishment Clause does with a metaphor. The metaphor is that of a wall. It is, number one, quite easy to remember. Number two, useless at best. And number three, frequently quite mischievous. It finds its origin in a letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802, in which he described both of the religion clauses as, and this is a quote, erecting a wall of separation between church and state. Now, is it really a wall? And does that metaphor really help our understanding? The very first Establishment Clause case to come before the United States Supreme Court was a case called Everson versus the Board of Education, which involved a New Jersey practice of paying for the bus fares for all children of certain ages who attended schools, including those who attended parochial schools. As is the case with most Establishment Clause litigation, therefore, Everson involved a governmental program that benefited some churches, at least in an indirect way. The Everson opinion is one of the truly astounding performances in the Supreme Court's history. The language of virtually the entire opinion talks of an absolute rule, a wall, and the opinion uses that phrase, and it defines the wall as being, in the court's opinion, high and impregnable and permitting no breach. And then in a single sentence, the majority holds that the bus fare reimbursement program is constitutional. I believe it was Elder Dallin Oaks who said that it isn't much of a wall if a bus can get through it, but a prayer can't. Just looking at Everson on its facts, reimbursement for bus fares may not seem like a very big thing, but it was a landmark because it was the first Establishment Clause case and because it forced the court to choose between, on the one hand, an impenetrable wall, which is dictum supported, and a rule which permitted at least some activities by government which affect religious institutions and religious values which its holding supported. Now, your first reaction may well be that it would have been cleaner and easier and better for the Republic if we had simply adopted the wall metaphor and said there is going to be no contact, no support, no help between government on the one hand and churches on the other. But before you reach that conclusion too quickly, let me point out two things to you. The first is that our 200 years of history are full of many instances which have become accepted aspects of our culture in which official governmental acts acknowledge our religious history, our religious heritage, and constitute an official governmental identification on the side of things religious. One familiar example is the celebration of Christmas as an official governmental holiday. Even Scrooge, in his early unrepentant stage, wouldn't take that one on as much as he wanted to. Other examples include the reference to deity in our national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance, the inscription on our coins. And I don't know how many of you have ever attended an opening session of the United States Supreme Court, but it all begins with the incantation by the marshal of his familiar Oye, Oye, and then at the end he says, God save the United States and this honorable court. Rumor has it that on one occasion the marshal slipped and said, God save the United States from this honorable court. I was not there, and I know not where that happened. But these kinds of references are the kinds of things that we take for granted, but the kinds of things that probably would not be permitted if the wall really were high and impenetrable. Now, the second thing that I want you to consider is that the issue has some rather large financial and not just symbolic significance. If the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in Everson had gone the other way, as it would have if there had been just one change of vote, it is hard to see how the provision of our income tax laws that permits a deduction for contributions to churches could have survived. And at that point, the issue becomes very important. because it would make a difference of literally thousands of dollars every year to most income-earning people within earshot of my voice. Most of the Establishment Clause cases subsequent to Everson have arisen out of the same factual context, which is governmental programs that are helpful to religion. And most, though not all, have involved the same kind of effort involved in Everson itself, that is, governmental aid to parochial schools. About 16 years ago, in a parochial school aid case called Lemon versus Kurtzman, the court articulated a famous three-part test, which later cases have held is applicable not only to church school aid cases, but to all Establishment Clause challenges as well. Those three prongs of the Lemon test require, first, that government act with a secular rather than a sectarian purpose, that the primary effect of what government has done neither advance nor inhibit religion, and third, that there not be undue entanglement between government and religion. Though there has been at least one instance, and arguably more, in which the court has decided Establishment Clause cases since 1973 without applying that three-part test, it now appears to be rather firmly established as the basic constitutional requirement for Establishment Clause validity. The principal reason for its inadequacy is the rigidity with which the Supreme Court has applied the three prongs. Beyond any dispute, inquiries such as the purpose and the effect of a governmental program are relevant to its constitutionality. But the problem is that the court has not only required that all three of the prongs be satisfied as a prerequisite to constitutionality, it has also been quite inflexible in its application of some of those prongs. For example, it is now quite clear that any program which requires or permits governmental employees simply to go on to the premises of church-owned schools as part of their official duties, at least at the elementary and secondary levels, violates the effects prong of the three-part test, and for that reason alone renders the scheme unconstitutional as an establishment of religion. It is a per se rule. And this has led to some really absurd results. My principal candidate for the absurd result under that test is a case called Aguilar versus Felton, in which the court considered about 3 years ago what is almost universally regarded as the most successful of the congressional efforts to provide equal opportunities for educationally deprived children. The program provided remedial reading, math, and other services for children in geographically, economically deprived areas. And Congress quite sensibly reached the conclusion that it wanted those services to be provided for all economically deprived school children, including those who attended church-sponsored schools. After several years working with the program, and based on their actual experience with this program, its public administrators found that the only effective way to provide those remedial services was at the place where the students went to school during their regular school hours. Because what experience showed was that keeping them after school hours stigmatized them to an extent that adversely affected their ability to learn. And transporting them after hours to a public school was even worse. The virtually unanimous view of the public educators was that instruction on the parochial school premises for the parochial school children during regular school hours was the only really effective way to provide those remedial services, and that using this approach, the program had been very successful. Moreover, it is difficult to perceive any harm that comes from the bare fact of public employees stepping onto church property during school hours for the purpose of providing that instruction, and it would have been unconstitutional to have the church personnel do it. The thought that public teachers, from the bare fact that they step onto church property, my therapy become religiously indoctrinated was not supported by the record in that case, and really is nothing less than absurd. Nevertheless, applying the rigid three-part Lemon v. Kurtzman analysis, the Supreme Court held the scheme unconstitutional because the presence of non-church personnel on parochial premises violated the effects prong of the Lemon test. Now, what about the Free Exercise Clause? Has the court performed any better with respect to that provision? I believe that the answer is yes, both in theory and also in practical effect. As is the case with all constitutional guarantees dealing with individual rights, the Free Exercise Clause protects only against acts of government. The basic constitutional test appears to be well established. The starting point was announced about 100 years ago in the polygamy cases, which involved a distinction between belief on the one hand and conduct on the other. And the reason our ancestors could be convicted is while polygamy involved both conduct and also belief, the court was able to resolve that particular case by holding that while the church's belief in polygamy was protected, its practice was not. It is no longer true, as the court held, or at least stated by dictum, in United States versus Reynolds, that the First Amendment affords no protection to religious practices. And when you think about it, that's the only place that the constitutional protection really makes a difference. Because even in the most totalitarian countries, people can believe, so long as they don't do anything that reveals that belief. In any event, the current governing constitutional standard for free exercise of religion, including conduct, is this: that governmental acts which adversely affect the implementation of religious belief are constitutional only if the government can show that those acts are based on a compelling governmental interest not achievable through less intrusive means. The test has two parts, and government has to satisfy both. First, government has to show that its need to do whatever it is that it is doing is not just substantial, not just important, but compelling. And second, even if the governmental need is compelling, the infringement on individual liberty will nevertheless be unconstitutional if there was some other way that government could have achieved its objective. That is what is meant by the phrase, compelling state interest, not achievable through less intrusive means. Probably the leading free exercise case is a 1972 decision called Wisconsin versus Yoder. It's also a case whose facts illustrate the competing consideration that the courts take into account in deciding free exercise case and the tilt that the compelling state interest test gives to the individuals vis-a-vis their government. At issue in Yoder was a Wisconsin law which required all students to attend public or private high school until they reached age 16. Jonas Yoder and others involved in the case were adherents of the Amish faith, which permitted formal schooling only through the eighth grade. Beyond that, they believed in providing their own education in their own way. It was accordingly a classic case of conflicting governmental interests on the one hand and individual liberty interests on the other. On the one side of the balance scale, education is one of the most fundamental of government's activities, and an educated populace is certainly in society's interest. On the other hand, compulsory education beyond the eighth grade was conduct squarely at odds with Amish belief. The reason that Mr. Yoder and his Amish colleagues won and the state of Wisconsin lost is that this prevailing, compelling state interest test gives a decided advantage to the individual vis-a-vis his government. Though Wisconsin's interest in having an educated populace was strong, it was not compelling. Moreover, compulsory education was not the only means available to the state for achieving that objective. Thus, the court's opinion notes that the Amish people not only accept the necessity for formal schooling through the eighth grade, but they also continue to provide effective vocational education for their children in the adolescent years. The Establishment and the Free Exercise Clauses deal, at least at a first level of analysis, with quite different and separate matters. One is a structural provision, and the other an individual rights guarantee. Most of the Supreme Court cases, like Everson and Felton and Yoder, involve one or the other, but not both. But the most interesting and sophisticated religious liberty cases are those whose fact situations necessarily involve both clauses and the relationships between the two. In the interest of time, I'll explore only two of these. Probably the best known case involving tension between the two clauses is a 1963 decision called Sherbert versus Verner. Adele Sherbert was a devout Seventh-day Adventist. She was also unemployed. The unemployment compensation laws of the state of the state of South Carolina, where she lived, provided that she would be ineligible for unemployment compensation if she refused employment for which she was eligible. The only work that she'd been able to find was in a textile mill, which would have required her to work on Saturdays. The infringement on her free exercise rights was different from that involved in Yoder, because the Wisconsin compulsory attendance law in Yoder gave the Amish no option. They had to send their children to school. By contrast, South Carolina's workman's compensation law imposed no affirmative obligation on Ms. Sherbert. It simply set conditions for eligibility for unemployment compensation, and then she had to make the choice, and if she complied with one of those conditions, it would have put her into conflict with her religious belief. Nevertheless, it was the free exercise considerations that prevailed, and Ms. Sherbert won her case. And in a consistent line of cases since that time, the court has held that the Free Exercise Clause prohibits government from conditioning eligibility for otherwise available governmental benefits on the individual's doing things that would offend his or her religious beliefs. Now, if you look at that issue strictly from the standpoint of free exercise doctrine, the court was clearly right. But the fact of the matter is, free exercise concerns are not the only relevant constitutional values in that case. Consider this. The state of South Carolina had set a condition for unemployment compensation eligibility that the applicant be, quote, available for work. And the South Carolina courts had consistently applied that to mean that unavailability for any personal reasons, no matter what they were and no matter how compelling, did not satisfy the statutory condition. This means that the United States Supreme Court's holding in Sherbert versus Verner carved out one exception from the otherwise consistently applicable state law, and that single exception depends on religious belief. The net upshot of all of this was that government, acting through the United States Supreme Court, has carved out an exception from otherwise applicable state law, and that exception is keyed exclusively to religion. The only ones who are excused from that requirement of being available for work are those who have, as their excuse, a religiously based reason. Clearly, if the only considerations were the Establishment Clause and the only test that you applied were the Lemon three-part test, that would flunk. Nevertheless, the tension between the two clauses is readily apparent. This is one instance in which the two have come into conflict. And in Sherbert versus Verner, it was the free exercise values that prevailed. Let me mention just briefly one other one. In a recent Supreme Court case called Widmar versus Vincent, The court held that the University of Missouri's practice of excluding religious groups and only religious groups from the extracurricular use of its Kansas City classrooms was a violation of the free exercise rights of the religious groups. The free exercise interests were obvious because the religious groups had been singled out and discriminated against solely on the basis of the fact that they were religious clubs. But the reason that the University of Missouri had adopted this particular policy was not because of any antipathy toward religion. Rather, those who adopted the policy thought that they were required to do so because of the Establishment Clause concerns. If they permitted church groups to use government property for church purposes, they feared that the prohibition against entangling church and state would be violated. In virtually every instance in which these two clauses have come into conflict, it has been the free exercise clause that has prevailed. The final category of cases that I want to discuss with you involving the interrelationships between these two clauses are the so-called accommodation cases. This is a fairly recently developed body of law. These cases involve the constitutionality of laws whose purpose is to remove barriers to the free exercise of religion or otherwise to facilitate free exercise. They are like the parochial school aid cases in that they involve government efforts which benefit religion and therefore raise Establishment Clause concerns. But the parochial aid cases are different in that those involve direct financial benefits and they are not directly aimed at facilitating free exercise. The most recent accommodation case, and I think the leading case, arose out of what I think was the LDS Church's first appearance in the United States Supreme Court since polygamy days. It involved the constitutionality of a key provision of Title VII, which is the federal statute that prohibits employment discrimination by all employers in the United States on the basis of race, sex, national origin, or religion. Section 702 of that statute exempts religious employers, church employers, from the prohibition against employment discrimination based on religion. That is, it permits churches as employers to hire only members of their own faith if they choose to do so. Methodists can hire Methodists, Jews can hire Jews, and Mormons can hire only Mormons. When originally enacted in 1964, there was such an exception for religious employers, but it was limited to, and I'm quoting, work connected with the carrying on of religious activities. In 1972, the exemption was broadened to eliminate the religious activities qualification. And the net upshot was that as of 1972, churches were free to hire their own members without regard to whether the work for which they were employed was religious in nature or not. Constitutionality of this exemption provision, Section 702, was attacked by an employee who was threatened with dismissal from a maintenance position at the Deseret Gym in Salt Lake because he did not hold a current temple recommend. He contended that exempting churches from discriminating in employment on the basis of religion, which that employment policy clearly was a violation of the Establishment Clause because it gave to church employers an exemption that no other employers enjoyed. Relying on the traditional three-part Establishment Clause test that we have reviewed this morning, he argued that the exemption ran afoul of the effects prong because it gave religious employers a privilege that no other employers enjoyed. The district court ruled in his favor, holding that the maximum permitted by the Establishment Clause was the 1964 congressional exception, which was keyed to work connected with religious activities. The United States Supreme Court reversed, with all nine justices agreeing that the statute was constitutional, at least insofar as the church's nonprofit activities, such as the Deseret Gym was, are concerned. It is a significant opinion for several reasons. First, the court reasserts that Congress as was the case in Amos itself, or the state legislatures have some room within which they may permissibly legislate in order to accommodate religion between the constitutional floor that is provided by the Free Exercise Clause and the ceiling that is provided by the Establishment Clause. For this reason, the Court found it unnecessary to pass on whether Section 702 was constitutionally required by the Free Exercise Clause. One of the most interesting opinions is that of Justice Brennan, with whom Justice Marshall joined. That opinion is the clearest articulation thus far of the First Amendment-based rights of religious organizations. That is, the churches also have free exercise rights. It is sometimes referred to as a constitutional right of church autonomy. Justice Brennan reasoned as follows. Certain activities are in furtherance of an organization's religious mission, and only those committed to that mission should conduct them. Solicitude for a church's ability to do so reflect the idea that furtherance of the autonomy of religious organizations often furthers individual religious freedom as well. Given the recognition by both the majority opinion and also Justice Brennan's concurrences that churches also have First Amendment-protected rights, Amos also presents the clearest example in the Supreme Court's history of a confrontation between the free exercise rights of individuals on the one hand and religious organizations on the other. And frankly, you wouldn't have thought, given that choice, that it would have been the organization that would have won. The burden on the individual was very similar to the burden on Ms. Sherbert. In order to keep his job at Deseret Gym, Mr. Mason had to conform to religious practices with which he did not agree. On the other hand, both the majority and Justice Brennan agreed that the church has a constitutionally based right to determine what its own religious objectives are, and also to determine that these objectives can be best achieved by persons who agree with them. As I read the opinions, the church's interests prevailed because in that particular case they were more weighty than those of the individual. But the principal free exercise significance of the case is its implicit recognition that there is something on the church's side of the balance scale. In conclusion, what are likely to be the large freedom of religion issues over the next few decades? My guess is that we can expect more assaults on the three-pronged establishment of religion test, even though the assaults on that test that were mounted 3 or 4 years ago were not successful. The three-part test, in its present rigidity, quite simply gives results such as Aguilar versus Felton that are so far out of harmony with sound principles and common sense that some change has to be made. I also think that in the wake of the Amos case, we may see a new round of cases that will further develop the accommodation principles and specifically the free exercise rights of religious institutions, complementing and supplementing those of individuals. But the safest prediction of all is that the religion clauses will continue to be a fruitful and fascinating source of Supreme Court litigation, and that the basic provisions will continue to guarantee that this country will enjoy religious liberty of a quality that is unmatched in most parts of the world and unexcelled in any. Thank you.